security program on spreadsheets, new regulations piling up, an audit dread. It's time for Vanta. Vanta automates security and compliance, brings evidence into one place, and cuts audit prep by 82%. Less manual work, clearer visibility, faster deals, zero chaos. Call it compliance or call it compliance. Get it? Join the 15,000 companies using Vanta to prove trust. Get started at vanta.com/calm.
Most people believe that if something is true, it will come out. That's how justice works. That system works, but that's not always the case. Now, what happens behind closed doors? Is it very different from what people think? Today, I'm joined by Greg Owen. Greg has lived a life most people can't even imagine, going from being a musician to becoming a prosecutor, handling serious crimes in Chicago. Greg, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to have you on the show. You have a remarkable life. And I just, I just want to get right into it because it's amazing. Your life story and what you've done just blows me away. So I just have to start here. You went from a musician to a prosecutor. That's a massive shift. Because most people feel stuck in one identity most of their life. How did you make that transition?
Well, first of all, thank you very much, Stacey, for having me. I've really been looking forward to this for as long as I can recall. And you do a great job. Love your show. So my life was sort of unusual. I played music since I was a kid, real young, 9 to 12. My mother made me take piano lessons. And then I decided when I saw the Beatles and some of these other bands that I wanted to be a musician. That was going to be my life. But I had this problem took place when I was young called the Vietnam War. Mm-hmm. So when I got done with high school, if you weren't in school, college, you got drafted. So I went to college. My professors were very amenable to me playing and touring. So I played all through college. When I got done with college, I was lucky I wasn't going to get drafted, I found out. And then I went to law school because as a musician, we had been taken advantage of so many times by lawyers and managers. We'd make records, we'd make no money. I mean, we'd sign away everything just to go on tour and be on stage. We weren't even thinking about the business side.
Right.
And I was had a little, my mind was always a little more like the leader of the band. I've always thought about the business aspects of it. So I went to law school. I went every other semester. I toured the other semester. It took me 4.5 years. And then when I got finished, I had long hair past my shoulders, earrings, braids, the whole bit. I love playing. I love being on stage. I recorded for 4 different record labels. And I love my life. But at one point, something occurred that sort of changed me internally. And it had to do with a woman. At the time, sort of broke my heart. And I was starting to question my own talent. Right. I was good, but I couldn't sing. And back in the day, if you couldn't sing, you were sort of dependent on everybody else.
Right.
Well, that started to bother me. And then I saw a note on a bulletin board at my law school that said the Cook County State Attorney's Office would be interviewing for interns to possibly be prosecutor. And I stood there and looked at that note, and something inside me told me, you better do that. You better do that or else. It was scary, obvious.
Yeah.
I looked around, I turned away, and then I felt it again. And I looked back again. And the note said that somebody would be there to interview candidates the next day. This was a Wednesday. It was on a Thursday. And I was so motivated by what I felt inside. I called my mother. I said, could you get the guy to cut your hair to cut my hair? She said, are you okay? There's something wrong with you? I said, no, Ma, it's something I got to do. So I got my hair cut that night. She took me to a JCPenney, a store, got me a suit and outfit. And the next day I showed up for that interview. And the man said to me, there's a lot of crime and we have a budget problem and we really need law school students or interns who are allowed now by the Supreme Court to try cases if you're supervised. I didn't know what he was talking about. I didn't know. I'd never even been in a courtroom.
Wow.
Can you show up Monday afternoon after your class? I only went to school in the morning then. And I said, yeah. So I went and I met a guy named Bill Kunkel. Now, that's an interesting name. He was the supervisor of this misdemeanor court prosecutor area. He ended up becoming the prosecutor of a guy named John Wayne Gacy, who was considered the worst mass murderer in the history of America. That's who hired me. That's who I got hired by, that man, Bill Kunkel. So he sent me to this courtroom. I didn't know anything. I never, and I walked in and I was supervised. 2 weeks later, I just began to love it. I loved every minute of it. And I really transformed myself from being this rock, I mean, I still love music, to this prosecutor. I took the bar exam, and something occurred the day I took the bar exam. As I was taking the bar exam, a man named Tony Messina in Chicago, about a 51-year-old man, Greek, Greek and Italian both, had tried to find his son for 2 days. He couldn't find him. And he was concerned because his son worked for him. His son was 24. His name was Gio. And so Tony decided to drive downtown Chicago to where his son's girlfriend lived. And he got there and he saw his son's car parked out in front. And he got more concerned. He walked up to the building and he saw a building janitor, superintendent, and the janitor let him into the building, but would not let him in that apartment. Finally, he talked the janitor and letting him in. They open the door, and there he finds his son stabbed to death and the girlfriend in big, huge pools of blood. I mean, horrific. Well, while that's happening to him, I'm taking the bar exam. I know nothing about this, right? After I get finished that day, my mind is on one thing. It's flying to LA the next day to be with my old band. They're going to be doing an album. I felt sort of bad, but it takes 2 months to get the results. So I figured I'd hang with them. So my brother calls me that same evening after I got home from the bar exam. And I had just seen a newspaper being stuffed in a paper box, evening edition. And the headline said, "Contractor, comma, actress found slain." Had a picture on the side of a very attractive young woman. I wanted to get the paper, but I had no change, so I just went in the house. But anyway, my brother calls me maybe half hour, 45 minutes later, and he says to me, "I'm so upset. I'm so bummed out, Greg." My brother Jay. He said, "My friend got murdered, him and his girlfriend." And I said, "Wait a second. Where?" He said, "In Chicago." I go, "Are you kidding me? I just saw a newspaper headline." I said, "Was your friend a contract? Was dad was? Was the girlfriend an actress?" "Yeah, she just graduated from Goodman Theater School. She was getting some acting gigs." "My God, Jay, I feel so bad. I never knew this guy." So the day I took the bar exam, the father finds his son. My brother calls me to tell me it's his friend. And 4 years later, I prosecute that case. The odds of that don't even exist. I didn't go seeking the case out. And the book tells about. First of all, it gives a more detailed background on my career as a musician, a lot more detail on why I left. I mean, it was pretty bad, and how I became a state's attorney, what my job was like, and how we dealt with corruption. I mean, the system in Chicago was so corrupt. There was so much bribery. It was almost blatantly in front of us. I mean, it was like, oh my God. And that was the way I had to learn to be a lawyer and to be a prosecutor is in the midst of the worst corruption, probably in American history, that was taking place. And as a result, even in this case, when I got involved in it, I mean, the witness was going to take the fifth. He wouldn't want to testify. He was afraid we'd prosecute him. Evidence had been stolen. And so it was just a bad situation. And my attitude was, this kid, this rich kid, he's not about to walk away from a double murder and not even get a trial. Just we're going to drop it. So my partner and I took on the case. And the thing about that case was, there was no money stolen. There was a lot of money. There was drugs. Nothing was taken. And the person who did the killing was a friend of the victim's. And we never could understand why he did it. What was the motive? I mean, I had to stand in front of a jury and say, "Ladies and gentlemen, the judge is going to tell you soon that the state do not have to prove a motive. because we can't get into somebody else's head. You know, you can say all you want, but people want to know, they want to know why this happened.
Yeah.
So that was something that sort of hung over my head, like, why would this guy do this? He had
Yeah.
everything going for him in his life. They were really well-to-do people, you know, but the
Yeah.
victims, everybody. And yet he stabs him with an 11-inch butcher knife in front of a witness, you know. So the motive part of the book itself, as you read the book, we want people to tell us, why do you think he did it? What
Right.
is it in the story? Because we get pretty much details, and we talk about the trial itself. We go into sidebars, and that's another thing. People have watched crimes on true crime cases on TV. You know, there's been
Yeah.
a lot. And one of the things that's frustrating, I'm sure, for viewers is the lawyer says, "Judge, can we have a sidebar? Can I approach?" And all of a sudden, the fan starts turning. You don't see anything else but that, and you have
Yeah.
to. Well, in our book, we tell the reader what is being said in sidebars. And
Right.
believe it or not, what goes on in sidebars is often more interesting than what goes on in the courtroom.
Right.
And the average person does not know about what is being said and what the conversations are like. And
Yeah.
they're very brutal, very, very hostile at times, you know, because you're arguing for a position, and you want your position to be the one the judge listens to. And
Yeah.
so fight very strongly, which you can't do that in front of a jury. You can't, that's not allowed. Well,
Yeah.
you do it in the judge's chambers on a sidebar. So, I mean, it gives insights, and the book is everything. I'm writing more books, but this one, all of them are going to tell you from the prosecutor's point of view,
Right.
what we did, how we felt, you know, why we did what we did, how we went about doing it, the challenges we faced, and they were numerous in every case. You know,
Yeah.
because it's our job to prove the person guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and that's not an easy burden.
Right.
So that gives you a little idea of, you know, what went on, how I transitioned. I had a great life as a musician. I was in a band. We opened up for the Doors.
Oh, really?
We opened up for the Doors. We opened up for Janis Joplin,
Oh, wow.
big company. We opened up for Buffalo Springfield, which was Neil Young and
Wow.
Stephen Stills.
Yeah.
We opened up for the Cream.
Oh, wow.
Back in the day, I mean, it wasn't as, I mean, you could open up for a Stevie Winwood, Spencer Davis. I mean, you could open up for big groups, and we were all treated about the same. It wasn't like today. I mean, we shared
Yeah.
this dressing room. You know, people were musicians. I mean, they were famous, but they didn't come off like that, you know. It
Yeah.
was more of a
Yeah.
musician camaraderie. So, like I said, we shared the same dressing room with these people.
That's
So definitely,
amazing.
it was quite a life.
That is so amazing. Now, let's talk about something that people don't think about enough. Is the truth enough?
No, the truth is not enough. You have to corroborate the truth. And what I mean is this. Somebody says, I was there and I saw this person, the defendant, stabbing somebody. Okay. Now he's telling the truth. But what is the defense going to do? They're going to make it seem like maybe he was the killer. So even though he's telling the truth, how do you establish in the minds of a juror, someone listening and making a decision, that the person you have is telling the truth?
Right.
Oh, corroboration. Corroborate. You have to present other facts that make what that witness said seem true, even more true.
Yeah.
Did he tell anybody after he saw it happen? How was he dressed? Was his clothes disheveled? I mean, there's so
Yeah.
many things. The truth on its face is not enough.
Right.
Not never. I mean, almost never. I mean, it's a hard thing to sell 12 people on sending someone to prison or wherever on
Right.
the word of somebody, even if he's telling the truth or she's telling it, either he or she. So you need to come up with other things, physical evidence that bolster the truth,
Yeah.
that make the truth easier to believe and to grasp. Absolutely. Yeah, it's not enough.
Now, what
No.
do people misunderstand about how things actually work?
Well, people are too much, especially today, hung up on TV series, you know, that TV dramas, courtroom, they think that's how it works. Very rarely in my entire life I've ever seen anything that's even close to the way it really works.
Right.
There's been something here and there, and that's part of why we wrote these. I wrote this book. I was writing with my partner who passed away just before we started, which was a
Oh,
sin.
so sorry.
But we would sit there and we would say, if people saw what really happens,
Yeah.
it's so much better than what you see in the movies. And they miss the point.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, how often have you seen anywhere in any movie or drama about a crime, have you seen a young prosecutor interview the victim's family, the
Right.
mom and dad, and the kind of things that are said to that young prosecutor who maybe isn't married, like I wasn't, didn't have children yet, and you're trying to relate to a man and woman who have been crushed, whose life will never be the same ever.
Right.
And they're talking to you, and like I said earlier, I remember a case where a woman said to me, her son had been beat to death. She said, Mr. Rowan, which I thought was funny because I'm younger than her, but Mr. Rowan, do you think it hurt as he was dying? She said, do you think he knew he was dying? Now, when you're 26 and there's an adult, then you really realize the depth of the horror that these people experience, that they have to think about that at times. How did he feel? Did he know he was going to die? And here's me trying to say anything. I mean, what am I supposed to say? I don't know. They want something. I go, and you do your best to soft sell it and say, I'm sure it was fast. I'm sure, but you know it wasn't. You know it was horrific, and it was horrible. It was like torture. But you never appreciate how much a mother and father love their children until you're sitting in that position and someone's until you became a until you become a parent. Then you
Right.
understand. But before that, you don't have a clue, except we did.
Yeah.
And it's our job to give voice to those people and to their loved one, because the voice of their loved one had been extinguished by this killer.
Yeah.
So your job is to get out there and let the people know who they were.
Right.
Give them a seat at the table, just like the defendants at the table. We would almost think in terms of the victims are sitting alongside of us, and we're representing them, which is what we
Yeah.
were.
Right.
So, yeah, it was. You grow up real fast. I go from a band on stage a year later, and I'm sitting next to people saying, talking that like stuff to me. You change overnight.
Oh,
I
yeah.
mean, you learn what life is really about.
Right.
So, yeah, it wasn't. It was fulfilling, but it wasn't pleasant oftentimes. You
Right.
know, you yeah. So, but like I said, we felt good when we knew at least justice had been served. Doesn't bring back
Exactly.
the loved ones. And I tried as a jury trials, of all the jury trials I tried, there was only three that weren't murder cases. And so
Wow.
because we had so many murders in Chicago at the time, we
Yeah.
literally could not, we did not have time to try a burglary or a robbery.
That's
We didn't have, there
crazy.
was too many murders. We were on trial. I mean, to think in terms of by the time I was there 3.5 years, 40 murder trials to a jury. That means
Wow.
13, almost 12 a year. That means every single month we were on trial with a murder, and we were. I mean, it
That's
was a
crazy.
life experience. Yeah.
You've seen things behind the scenes that most people will never. And you know, what happens behind the closed doors that would surprise people?
I would say the preparation that goes into actually calling witnesses to the witness stand, that's one thing. In other words, it's not just a random, throwing cards and say, okay, you actually strategize who you're going to put on first, second, third, what time of the day you're going to put them on. And I'll tell you something else that I think people will find interesting. I learned from a skilled one of my first supervisors was the best. His name was Tom Breen. He's still a big Chicago lawyer. Well, when he was a young prosecutor, he was so good, and I was fortunate to work with him. He taught me something called the choreography of the courtroom, meaning there's no accidents. It's
Right.
planned. So say a witness is on the witness stand. There's a jury sitting off to the side, and you're the prosecutor.
Right.
What you want to do is you want the jury to feel what the witness is saying while they're saying it. And you want them to get the sense that this person is telling the truth.
Right.
Well, one of the problems is people, when they take the witness stand, are scared. They're scared, they're nervous, they've never been here before. And so you have to do what you can to convey that truth to the jury.
Yeah.
So you would position yourself as the questioner in a place so the jury boxes say right here, the witnesses, I would stand. So when I was standing, the witness would see me, but look right into the jury's eyes.
Wow.
That's something nobody knows about, because what would happen is the witness would be looking at me, but because the jury was between me and the witness, they'd look right in the jury's eyes. And that made it so much easier for the jury to feel the truth, how they felt, sympathy, whatever.
Yeah.
And then when you would cross-examine a witness who was not your witness, you'd move yourself into the center of the courtroom. So
Yeah.
when you're asking them questions, they're not looking at the jury, they're looking away from the jury. The jury tends to think, why aren't they looking at us now? That's the one thing. They start wondering, is the person trying to hide something? I mean,
Yeah.
those are strategies that you use. I mean, a lot of things, how we dressed, everything. My closing argument, everyone I ever did, I wore a black suit with a black vest, black shoes, no watches, no rings, nothing.
Wow.
And that was part of the tradition for me and some of my partners. And so the preparation, I think, because as a prosecutor, your job is to find the witnesses, call them to the witness stand, and get them prepared.
Right.
That's a big thing because, like I say, these people are beside themselves. I mean, and so in the story, we talk about real specific instances where preparing a witness sometimes was tough, you know.
Yeah.
And I also talk about what a witness told me once when they were sitting, the woman, it was a woman, lady, when she was sitting in the back of the courtroom waiting for her turn to be called, and she was sitting in a room all by herself. And she described it this way. She said, "You know, Greg, when I walked into the courtroom, it brought back a memory of when I had my first child." I'm like, "What's that mean? You know, what?" She goes, "Well, you know, when you're ready to have a baby," she says to me, "you're nervous. You know, you're looking for it, but you're really sort of scared, you know.
Yeah.
You put on a gurney and you're wheeled into this bright room, bunch of people there, a room that you maybe never been in before, and it feels like everybody's looking at you."
Right.
That's what it felt like walking from that where that witness was sitting into then all walking into a courtroom, going up in the witness stand. And everybody in that bright light staring at them.
Wow.
The difference was when they get on the witness stand, the baby is born. But in this case, no. You have to sit there and listen to it and answer questions to an attorney who's trying to rip your throat out,
Right.
cross-examination. So the pain goes on, you know, and we have to prepare them, you know, tell them things like when you're being crossed, you wait 2 seconds before you answer. Give us a chance to possibly object. It
Right.
gives you a chance to think clearer. I mean, it's under the pressure, you'd be surprised. 2 seconds seems like a long time, and it is.
Yeah.
And then you can compose yourself. And the other thing we tell the witnesses, now when you're on the witness stand on direct, when we ask you questions, you're going to be like friendly. You're going to be nice, you know, back and forth. But when the defense attorney or the other attorney gets up, he's going to grill you, or
Yeah.
she. She's going to try to rake you through the coals. You can't change your attitude. Don't all of a sudden become hostile. Don't argue. I mean, it was tough, but because it makes all the difference in the world when a jury hears somebody on cross, if you watch
Yeah.
the case on TV, and they start getting smart mouthed to the lawyer,
Yeah.
their credibility goes right down the tubes.
Right.
So we had to really work hard. We would practice cross-examination with witnesses. You know, we'd say, okay, now here's what it's going to be like. And my partner would play the defense attorney.
Yeah.
He would cross-examine them. And we would do that all the time.
Right.
So the amount of preparation that goes into this is beyond what people consider or even
Okay.
know. And that's one of the things.
It's pretty amazing. Like, what
Yeah.
does it mean for everyday people who are trying to navigate life or just like tough situations?
I would say, well, the first thing I believe in is you got to believe, you got to feel within yourself. I mean, you got to operate from your intuition, your gut, you know, and as you go through life, make a point of listening to yourself. I think that's where people, you know, there's too much noise. They got music playing, people talk. And whether you meditate or not, that's a different issue. But the point is to be silent, to just be in your car and let things come to you. You'd be surprised. Now, I'm a believer, of course, needless to say, and I believe there's a spirit inside of me that tells me 99.9% of the time the thing to do. May not be something I want to do, but it's never wrong. And
Yeah.
if you listen to that and you really give yourself an opportunity to quiet down, you know, you'd be surprised.
Yeah.
You'd be surprised what you hear. And that's sort of, if I could tell anybody anything, is get in tune with who you are. You know,
Right.
don't sell yourself short. You can
Right.
do things that you never would have dreamt you could do. Look at me. I would never would have thought I'd go from a band to a prosecutor to a magazine publisher to a entrepreneur in a technological field. I never thought I would do any of those things. Something inside me told me to proceed. I did. And I used my the brain the good Lord gave me, thank you God, and I acted on it, and I
Yeah.
didn't question it, you know, unless it told me it was wrong. I mean,
Right.
there's been times, especially in relationships, where my insight said, "Nah, you probably shouldn't. She's probably not the right one." Like, oh no, I should have listened.
Yeah.
We all should have. And I don't mean she. I just mean it could be the other way around,
Yeah.
woman with a guy. But I think we all have been in that situation where you know you can
Yeah.
feel this is not right and you go against it
Yeah.
and it always backfires on you. It's the worst thing you can do. So that's my advice.
It's so true. Like, how much does pressure and power influence, decisions?
Pressure and power. I tried, well, first of all, pressure was something that I mean, it was second nature to me. I mean, getting on a stage in front of 10,000 people or standing in front of a jury where the defendant's possibly looking at the death penalty and representing the victims, that was a lot of pressure. But the pressure itself, I sort of, in my case, I sort of loved it. I enjoyed the pressure. I enjoyed the challenge to my brain, you know, challenge
Right.
to my beliefs. So I didn't let that, I did not let that, I mean, I've had pressure situations that were not good, but I try to learn from every situation. I try to learn a little bit. So the next one comes up, I know how to handle it.
Right.
Power is very depressing at times, you know,
Yeah.
it's very, very debilitating because when you're trying to go up against the power, the whatever it is, you got to really, I mean, you got to really dig deep. I mean, power is when you're up against some powerful people that are trying to take you down. I've been there too. I mean, you know, so I held on to my faith. What can I say? I would pray for the best, you know, and try to get someone else aside from myself to come to me and give me some direction.
Right.
That's how I've handled it anyway.
Because I think a lot of people assume things are always fair, and is it actually true?
No, life is not fair one bit. I mean, not at all. When I would look at the people that were being murdered, raped, robbed, they didn't deserve that.
Yeah.
No, I mean, it's not fair. I mean, it's not fair at all. I mean, but you have to understand that's how it is. It's not
Yeah.
fair. And you have to make the best of it for yourself, regardless. There's no way around it. I mean, I think everybody that's lived their life of any period of time understands it's not fair.
Right.
The system should be fair. and the system of justice should be fair, and you should fight hard to make sure it is.
Right.
Because that's something we have at least some control over. We should. And I think whatever it is, I don't care a political issue, I mean, how many things do we see that we don't think are fair? You should never give up and just acquiesce to that unfairness. At least have a voice and say something about it and take a position and believe in it. Yeah.
I agree. Like, how do you stay grounded when making high stake decisions?
I stay grounded because I tend to think of a situation from the other person's viewpoint, from the other point of view. In other words, I never allowed myself to rise above anybody else. I mean, when you see the things I've seen, you learn that, you're just one person and you can make a difference, but you have to stay grounded. Otherwise, you lose sight of reality. And before you know it, you're part of the problem. You've created a problem for yourself. Oh, it's the worst thing you can do is get into an ego thing. And I mean, I've never considered all the things I've done in my life. They just happened and I just went with it. And I was never motivated by money. I was motivated by the challenge. It motivated me just to do it.
I love that. Now, let's bring this back to the audience. If someone is dealing with a difficult situation right now, what is the best way to think clearly and make better decisions?
Someone's in a critical situation, I would say you have to first not be listening to everybody else is telling you things. That's number one. Number two, be silent. Get in a place where you can think clearly, no matter how horrible it is. Because you have to feel yourself like that you do have some power. You have the power of your spirit. You have to not allow, you have a, not allow yourself to be overwhelmed as much as it can feel that way. Because when you become overwhelmed, you can't think anymore, and pretty soon the emotions controls the environment. You don't want that to happen. And I don't know, I'm maybe old-fashioned, but I believe in things. I believe in, seeking through prayer or whatever it takes, guidance, because and there's people in your life too. You'd be surprised when you're young, you'd be surprised what geniuses your parents are. You never realize it till you got a little older. Man, my parents were the smartest people on earth. I didn't think so then. And I think we have to recognize that as a person that older people have wisdom. And that's one thing I've gained over the years is wisdom, that experience. You've been through so many things, that you have an understanding of what may happen and possibly how to deal with it. I would say going to those, your own family, not to your boyfriend, girlfriend, because they're going to be on your team. You want to go with somebody who's been there, done that, and they can tell you what a possible resolution could be to your problem.
100%.
Yep.
Now, what's one mistake people make when they're under pressure?
They talk. They open their mouth. They say things. It's like a great example of pressure is when somebody gets arrested, right? What is the first thing you're supposed to know is don't say anything. You need a lawyer. People want to just start talking. They want to talk their way out of a problem. It never works. You got to take a step backwards and think clearly because you're in the midst of the whole thing, right? So I would say, don't say anything right away. Give your brain time to comprehend what you just heard or what you're facing. Because it's surprising when you give yourself a little time and you don't just respond and react quickly. More than often than not, something comes to you from inside that gives you the way to answer that at that moment.
Right.
But not if you start raising your voice and no, that won't work. It never works. Not for me, it never worked.
Right.
We've all done
Oh, we've all done it for sure. After everything that you've seen, like what's one thing you wish more people understood about the truth, decisions, or life?
I would like people to understand that they do have freedom of choice. They do have the ability to make decisions. They've been given that they have to. They have, like I said earlier, they have to take a step back. They have to try to look at it from the outside. One thing I tell people, when you're dealing with someone else, no matter what it is, you have to think. The way I was told when I was young as a lawyer was, you have to get behind the eyes of the person you're talking to. You have to see it from their point of view. You have to be willing to accept how they think, like it or not.
Right.
And that's how you analyze the resolution of this, whatever it may be. Somebody's accusing you. I mean, where are they coming from? Because it's a lot easier, even for yourself, to come up with an answer, is
Yeah.
if you at least understand where they're coming from, where the
Exactly.
situation's coming from. And to me, that's always been a big thing for me, is viewing it behind somebody else's eyes, the other
Yeah.
person.
Yeah. And not everybody finds that very easy. That's
No.
practice.
No, because they want to react right away, right? Like I said earlier, I said they want to, oh, no. Stop that. Take a break and think for a second. And even look at the person and just think, okay, now where are they coming from?
Yeah.
Okay. Because when you give yourself a moment to think, see, people think too much with their mouth. That's a bad, and I was a professional talker, okay? But we knew how to control it, you know,
Yeah.
and to think, but you know, our parents, think before you speak.
Right.
Anybody do that anymore? Is that old school or something? But that's the bottom line, is think for a take the say, like I would tell the witness, count 1001, 1002 before you respond.
Yeah.
Because it gives us a chance to object, but it also gives you a chance to really, and you'd be surprised in a heated situation how long 2 seconds is.
Right.
And when you do that, you help yourself. It, yeah.
That's so true. Now, tell us a little about your book and tell us where we can find your book
Sure.
and where it's available, and also give them a little information about the challenge again so they know where to find that too.
So the book is called Convergence. It's written by Jonathan Dixon and myself. I'm the storyteller. He does a big portion of the writing. And it's a story of a young prosecutor faced with a case that everybody said could not be one that would hurt him, meaning the prosecutor, me, and that people felt that these victims didn't really deserve to be represented because they were doing drugs. And how, because of my background, I felt that was ridiculous. That's not how life should be. Myself and my partner, Mike Goggin, we took it upon ourselves to take a case that nobody thought could be won, because we felt it was just so wrong that this young guy's money was going to buy him a ticket out of that courtroom. I mean, all the cases I prosecuted before this, most of the people didn't have any money, you know, they were poor. I mean,
Right.
whatever, they committed the crime, but they didn't have an opportunity. They were going nowhere. Here's a guy that had every opportunity in his life, and it just frosted me. After all the poverty I'd witnessed as a prosecutor and all the lack of hope, here's a guy
Yeah.
that had everything going for him, and he thought he was going to buy his way out. No way. And that's what the story's about, how you fight for justice even when it looks impossible to succeed. And like I say, the book is available at Amazon, book, you know, Goodreads, anywhere, every major bookseller is available.
Yeah.
It's called Convergence. It's been out since October. We've got like 91 five-star reviews on Amazon, 76 five-star reviews on Goodreads. So the book is being accepted as, I mean, it's a good book. I mean, it's a page turner, and of
Yeah.
course I'm going to say that, but it is. So yeah, and you can find me I do a lot of posting now. I never did any before in my life. October on Instagram at Greg Owen 26. So it's GREGGOWEN 26TH because I worked at 26 in California. So you'll enjoy some of these reels. They're
I'm sure I
they
will.
go in a quick little 1 minute previews of the book, but also of what I did and how we did it.
Right. I love that. I love that. And where can people find the challenge and find your website?
Okay, our website is 26thstreetbooks.com. It's 26thstreetbooks.com. 26, because our publishing company is 26th Street Books, again, based on where I have spent my career. And you go to 26thstreetbooks.com, and when you get there, you'll notice there's a special section that says Join the Motive Challenge. Means you have to read the book. After you read it, send us in 1,000 words or less why you think this killer killed his friends. And the best submission we receive, we will fly you to Chicago to meet with us, take you to all the relevant locations in the book, go to lunch, answer any questions you have, and feature you on our website and all my social media things. So it'll be recognition for someone who really puts the time in to think about why he might have done it.
Oh,
Because
I
I
love it.
figured, yeah.
That is amazing. I think I might even do the challenge. That
Yeah, you probably should try yourself. We'd love to have you in Chicago.
I'd
Yeah.
love it.
Yep.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely.
Go
No, I've said absolutely. We'd love to have you.
I think I'm gonna do it.
Well,
I want people to realize that the truth doesn't always speak for itself, that sometimes it has to be understood, questioned, and even fought for, and that there are more, aware. You have to be more aware of how things really work, because the better decisions you make, come from being more observant, more open-minded, and really, like you said, seeing it through the person's eyes, because that's, I think, is a really important factor. Because a lot of people, like you said, they just talk, and
yep.
they don't really look through the person's eyes. And I think we all have the capability. I think we just have to learn to practice it. But if you take a step back and you kind of like walk through that person's shoes for a second, and you think about how would I have felt if I went through that, and maybe think about how that person's personality is, and kind of revamp your thinking process about not how you think, but how would that person think? What's their personality? What did they go through? And then, you start to be a little bit more open-minded, and you start to understand things a lot. And I think that can help us in all areas of life, not just in specific situations or in crime, mysteries or crime scenes, but also in all areas of our life as well.
I agree totally. Very
Yeah.
well said.
I just
Very.
want to, I this has been an amazing time. I had such a great time listening to you. I think you have an amazing life. I think you've touched all areas of life. You've done a little bit of everything. And I love how, you really you had goals in your things you wanted to do. You went for it, you achieved it. And you did the things that you loved and you were most passionate about, and you continue to do that now. And I think that's wonderful. And I hope people see that if you have a dream, just go after it and do it, and not let your thoughts or your fears or the what ifs stop you. Because if you really want something, or if you're passionate about it, go after it, do it. We get rid of our fears by facing our fears, and
Yes.
be what you want to be, and try the things you want to do, and be that person that you want to become. Because we all have the capability, we just have to go for it. And I think you proved that today. And I just
Thank
want
you
to say
very
thank
much.
you. This has been
Again,
an
very
awesome
much.
time. I hope you'll come back. I hope we can talk more. And I
Absolutely. I'd
really
love to.
enjoyed this. I really enjoyed
Thanks,
this a
Stacey.
lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.